Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. On this month's show, I'll be talking with author and former Albuquerque Journal sports writer Toby Smith about his book, Crazy Fourth, How Jack Johnson Kept His Title and Put Las Vegas, New Mexico on the Map. It was just published by University of New Mexico Press. And a bit later, we'll meet a student artist from UNM who is using a giant shiny snail puppet to bring some joy and whimsy to Albuquerque neighborhoods. Jack Johnson was one of the most famous people in America around the early 20th century, not only for his legendary boxing skills, but also his gigantic personality. He was witty and charismatic. He liked flashy, fast cars, expensive suits, and liaisons and marriages with white women. A rabidly racist white America, in turn, sought desperately to find a white boxer who could beat him in the ring. The famous fight between Johnson and the so-called Great White Hope, Jim Jeffries, took place in 1910 in Reno, Nevada, and is the subject of a play and a movie of the same name. Johnson's victory brought celebrations and riots that included attacks and murders of black people across the country. 2 years later, promoters staged another fight, another attempt to take the heavyweight championship title away from Johnson. That took place in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Toby Smith's book, Crazy Fourth, documents the strange tale of Jack Johnson coming to Las Vegas to fight a man named Jim Flynn from Pueblo, Colorado, on July 4th, 1912.
They had fought once before in San Francisco. Johnson just demolished Flynn. They had to take him to the hospital. That's how bad it was.
Knowing how badly Flynn got shellacked by Johnson before, like, why did they choose him?
That's a good question. There was nobody else. There was really nobody else they could go to. Johnson had actually, he had been quite famous because he had gone down to, he beat Flynn in California. After that, the trip to Australia, because the real world champion was a guy named Tommy Burns. And Jack Johnson said, well, I want to be the heavyweight champion of the world, so I'm going to have to go down to Australia. And that's what he did. And he just, made Burns look like a two-year-old. And he did his typical grinning. Johnson was great at grinning. He loved to grin at opponents, especially when they were down and out and they couldn't get up and they tried to come over, and he hits them and then grins and then walks away, and that grin was his trademark. Yeah.
He's yelling racial epithets. Johnson's sort of taunting him, smiling. Even when he's headbutting him, he's smiling in the camera.
Yeah, the N-word was flashed quite prominently presented, which is a sad story but that was the times. I mean, yeah. You're going to hear the N-word all over the time at that time. And that's the way it is. Not like today, fortunately.
Yeah. Paint a picture of Jack Johnson. He was flamboyant. He was a sharp dresser, an amazing fighter. Why did he freak out white America?
Boxing was a very a popular sport in 1912. I mean, it was huge. It was big. And baseball, it outdid baseball. Everybody wanted to go to boxing. Not a lot of people wanted to see Jack Johnson, although it turned out that they did want to see him. So he fought Jim Jeffries. He had ruled the boxing world in the United States from early in that century. And he was a great fighter, But Jim Jeffries did not want to fight a black man. And this is what America wanted. They wanted to have Johnson go against Jim Jeffries because
wanted to see Johnson defeated by a white man.
Yes. And that's exactly right. And Jim Jeffries finally caved in and said, all right, those two fought, Johnson and Jeffries. Jeffries now the world champion, and Johnson knocked down Jeffries three times. And Americans couldn't understand how that happened. Because here's a great American white man, boxer. He was a strong, strong, strapping guy, but he was older and he was tired. And he got in the ring with Jack Johnson, and Johnson just obliterated him. And that was the end. And so America now was charged up. They got to have a white man in the ring. So this is where the whole idea of the Great White Hope. They were looking, okay, Jeffries is gone, so who can we pick? And they looked around, and then finally, poor old Jim Flynn, somebody gets an idea, he's probably available, even though he was He had fought once already, and Johnson just sort of smiled at that idea. I'll fight him, whatever it takes. I want to stay the world champion.
His promoter is quite an interesting person, Mr. Curley, James Curley. Was he motivated just by money?
Yeah, he wanted to fight. He wanted to have a fighter. You know, he could have anything he wanted. He did all sorts of things, but he didn't know anything about boxing, really, except he thought, Jack Johnson, that could bring a lot of money, that could do well. And, you know, when he was a promoter and he was hanging around there and let's do this. And so he got a hold of these three businessmen in Las Vegas and everything was going to be great. And then all of a sudden it was all over.
There was a ton of racism leveled against him, but he was very flamboyant. He married several white women, which also made him highly unpopular.
He was somebody that they didn't like because he did all the things that would bother white America. You know, you're right. He carried on with women, whether they were wives or not. He had a fast car. He drove that everywhere. He'd wave at people and they'd look at him and say, where did this black guy get an automobile? He's not supposed to drive an automobile. It was a convertible, you know, with a top down, and Johnson's there just having a ball. And so they all wind up in this little place called Las Vegas, New Mexico, which at that time had maybe 4,000 people.
Yeah, how did they talk about how they chose Las Vegas, the promoters? Why Las Vegas?
Well, because Las Vegas came up with the money to put Las Vegas, New Mexico on a map. They've got to get Jack Johnson there. And that's what really was the reason, nothing else. And nobody really had any beliefs that Johnson was going to lose to Jim Flynn. No one really thought that's never going to happen, but let's have a fight. We're going to get money. Las Vegas, New Mexico is suddenly going to be on the map, going to be a place that people have heard about. So we did that. So they did it with maybe, I'd say slightly under 4,000 people showed up. And
that was way less than they thought would show, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, they boarded trains. They came every which way they could come to Las Vegas. In the boxing ring, Jim Flynn showed himself right away in the first round, was not up to it, not up to it. Because Flynn decided, what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump up off the ground in the middle of the ring, off the mat, and headbutt Johnson in the jaw. And if you can imagine that, Johnson was about 4 inches taller, and he wasn't gonna take any of that stuff. Again and again, the referee of this fight, who was also a newspaper columnist in Chicago, he kept warning Flynn, "You've got to stop that. You've got to stop the headbutting." And you know, Johnson just went back to his corner and just sort of smirked and said, you know, this thing isn't going to go very long, I can tell. So Flynn was not doing very well in the ring from the very get-go of the fight. The fans were rooting for him, but, you know, he wasn't gaining anything, any points or anything, and he was never going to be able to knock down Johnson, and he's never going to be able to lose the fight. There was never going to happen. And the audience is booing. They don't like what they see. It looks stupid. It looks like it may have been set up, that sort of thing. Finally, things get toward the end, toward the ninth round. And this sheriff, so to speak, jumps in the ring. He had no business being in there to stop the fight. He wasn't the referee. He was just a sheriff who jumped over the ropes and said, I'm going to stop this fight. You know, on what charge? I don't know. And so the audience that were there, they just booed like hell. And, you know, they didn't like it at all. And there was, you know, many of them left before the fight was even started. So, you know, this is how it ended up badly. And Johnson won. It was a bad call at the end. They still could have fought a little bit more, but it was obvious that Johnson was going to win this fight no matter what. And you know, Flynn was staggering around the ring. He said later, I had to fight in my, this is Flynn, said, I had that fight easily won until they stopped him. He hadn't won a single round yet.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with Toby Smith about his book, Crazy Fourth, from University of New Mexico Press, about the little-known fight that took place between the famous pugilist Jack Johnson and Jim Flynn, the white man the racist press and public hoped would beat Johnson in the ring.
You know, after the Johnson-Jeffries fight in 1910, when sort of the great white hope was defeated, there were riots around the country.
Yes, this is a very sad thing, and because was a black man, and there were a lot of riots in the United States when that happened, because now a black man was the world heavyweight champion, and that shouldn't have happened. That's what white America felt. White America, you know, boxing was a big deal in that time. We look at boxing today, and it's sort of shoved into the corner. Maybe they do some boxing in the Olympics, of course, and that sort of thing. But back then, it was a whole nother thing. And
what was the reaction after this fight?
The fewer than 4,000 people were just, you know, getting in their cars and wanted to get out of town as quick as they could. It was considered a fight that maybe that somebody had pulled the strings or something like this. But basically, it was just, it shouldn't have been held. Although Flynn afterwards said he beat Johnson. He actually told newspaper writers, I won this fight. Well, he could hardly get up off the mat. He was battered every which way, and he had bruises all over him. And Johnson had a little cut in his chin. That's all he had. That was basically what happened. And a lot of people were disgusted by boxing at that time, and let's get back to baseball.
So the city fathers in Las Vegas were counting on this huge boon to sort of help restart the town. Yeah. It had the railroad and it had the Montezuma Hotel. And it sounds like they just lost their shirts.
Yes, they did. And yet at the end of the fight, there was talk, we should get another fight in this town. And they didn't get another fight for a long time. The three businessmen who gathered up this money and their hopes were high. And this was one thing that they really needed, because Las Vegas had, you know, it was a wild west town where people were shooting each other. There were robberies. It was a deadbeat town. But the fight was, you know, okay, let's have the fight. Maybe people will look at us in a better way here in Las Vegas, because that fight just hurt everything. It put Las Vegas in a bad light. It never recovered for a long time. And it was more or less a fight that would be forgotten. It's a nice town, Las Vegas. Now it's doing fine. And it's got a university. It's got all sorts of things going for it. But back in 1912, it didn't have much.
You write that Johnson battled the ugliest forms of racism his entire life, including his very last hours. What happened to him after this fight and then at the end of his life?
America figured out a way. Let's get him. And Johnson fled to Europe after this fight. He was had it. He didn't want to do any more. And there were all sorts of bad situations in his life. But he finally came back to the United States, and he was penalized by something called the Mann Act, which was made just for Johnson. This was an act that you cannot take a woman across state lines for immoral purposes. Nobody really knew what that was about, but they dropped the Mann Act on him, and he didn't want to go back and get it. So he fled to Europe, and he lived there for 3 years.
This is mostly because he was marrying white women, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Or having sex with white women. Yeah, one or the other. He came back to the United States, and he said, okay, we'll let you back in, but you got to have another fight. And he fought another guy. He was still the world champion, and he fought another man in Cuba, and it was about 110 degrees outside. And Johnson was older, he was heavier, he was slower, everything. And he lost that fight, and he was no longer the world champion. The idea was they went back to the Mann Act, and they said, okay, but but you're going to have to pay for this, and we're going to have to send you to a penitentiary. And he went went to Leavenworth in Kansas, and was there for almost a year. But he was a boxing coach. They loved him in that penitentiary. I mean, he was a hero. He taught guys how to box. And after that, everything was just a slow decline of his life. And he tried all sorts of things. He was in shows that went around the country. He was, who is Jack Johnson? He was older, he was tired. He didn't want to fight anymore. Every once in a while he needed money. So he got in a car and drove to Texas to do an engagement, which means I want to stand there and talk about my life. He was driving back from Texas to New York where he was living, and the car went off the road, and Johnson was killed. And this was in North Carolina, and he didn't survive. That was his end of his life. It was a sad ending. And he has come back now to be a person that is really looked up to. Right now, he's a great figure. He's on postage stamps. He's got everything. He's still a person that people like. Did you ever get to know Johnny Tapia?
No, I didn't. I know of him.
Yeah, he's a local boxer here. He was a big fan. He was just like Johnson. He'd smile at his opponents, and go like this. And Johnny Tapia, he'd seen Johnson do that. He had this little piece of footage one day, and he was watching Jack Johnson's fight on this thing. I was at his camp, and I said, "Who is that?" He said, "That's Jack Johnson." And I looked down, and I said, "My God, it is." And Johnny Tapia did the same thing. He'd go there, and he'd grin, he'd pound his chest, he'd look around like this, exactly what Johnson did, exactly.
That was author and former sports writer Toby Smith talking about his book, Crazy Fourth, which was just published by University of New Mexico Press. This has been a difficult year with the pandemic, social distancing lockdowns, a cratering economy, and protests sparked by the killings of African Americans by police. Ashley Abbott is a UNM student, a parent, and an artist, and she's working to bring some joy and whimsy to people with a giant, shiny snail puppet. Dubbed Brio, it has roamed various neighborhoods in Albuquerque. The project is a finalist in the International Bio Design Challenge.
Why did you want to do this project? How did you hit upon the idea of a snail?
Well, actually, I was batting around a number of ideas. The snail wasn't the first thing that occurred to me. I was thinking about a white buffalo. Mm-hmm. There were these reports of animals that were emerging from unknown places that hadn't been seen in the cities for a very long period of time. And because everything was finally still, because everything was shut down, they were allowed to come back out and creep into the city again. And so I was thinking, we really need to have something that can come on the streets that not only is kind of in animalistic form, but also addresses the fact that kids are having a very hard time right now with their massive changes in their life.
Do you actually get inside it and move it? Does it walk around?
So it's attached to wheels. The initial inception of the snail was to make it on top of a car, almost like a car float that I could drive around town. And then because of safety concerns, we decided to not. My in-laws were like, "You can't do that. Don't put it on the car. It's gonna blow over like a sail." So we brought it down to the ground and put wheels on it. And my father-in-law donated a trike as well as a lot of his time to help me to construct the base. And I welded a bunch of stuff together to make it so that it could fit with the trike and the platform. And so now we have a bike system for it.
How often do you go out? Where do you go? What do you do with the snail when you go out?
Well, we go to, we're trying to go everywhere. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking for are rainbows in windows, because there's this whole thing called the rainbow window connection that started in Italy and then moved around the world. Kids all over the world started doing the same thing with messages of hope painted on windows with rainbows. And neighbors would see it, kids would see it, and it just grew. And so it became like a very big thing all around the world. And then it started being mapped in Brooklyn. And the map was online in Brooklyn. And then it again, continued to grow around the world. We do it in a number of different ways. We look online to see where the rainbows are. And then we also just look around us to see where the rainbows are. And that's kind of how we find kids that are engaged in this kind of stuff. But then we're happy to visit with anybody. But that's the idea. We've been able to take it out a couple of times. And we're looking for more sounds that we can play, almost like an ice cream truck kind of like jingle that will bring kids out. And people can really see it from their windows too. Actually, when you're driving the snail by, you can see this amazing reflective quality of the gold holographic color of the snail shell. And so that actually draws a lot of attention too.
And is designed to give people joy, to give people hope?
Yeah, that's the idea. It's designed to bring a lot of excitement and joy and levity and the feeling that there are still unexpected good things that can happen too. I got part of this idea from seeing this puppet show that was in London. I wasn't there personally, but it was a TED talk that I saw about the puppet show in London, where there were these 11 meter tall puppets that just happened to pop up all of a sudden. And over a 4-day period, they produced this puppet show for people in the streets of London for free, for just anybody to experience. It was a very democratic way of doing it. And the reports back from that were just like these experiences of happiness and hope and delight. And this wasn't even in the face of any kind of trauma or any kind of giant epidemic or protests or anything like that. It was just art for art, to make people feel light and happy and interested, curious, delighted.
Tell me about the name Brio.
My daughter, Iduna, she's seen in a lot of the pictures with Brio wearing the pink princess dress. She was like, we should name him Shiny. And I was like, yeah, Shiny is a really good name. But we're also in like a Hispanic, largely, you know, Mexican-speaking, English-speaking community. Let's name him Brio.
What is the award there, the honor you have won?
Well, so I haven't won an award yet. The Biodesign Challenge that I am part of, that has been part of the inception to make the snail. I was part of this class at UNM with Andrea Pauly and Amy Piling. And the class was aimed specifically at doing this contest that would bring international light to artists here in New Mexico as well, emerging artists and student artists, and scientists and designers as well. It's a very cross-pollinated type of class. Initially, I had a very different project for that was gonna be more applicable to the desires of the contest, which is creating new materials and using these new materials to build sustainable projects that are interesting and using new technology. And when coronavirus hit, I was like, I have to do something else. I just have to put a pause on this thing that I was planning and really focus on what is happening right now and what people need right now. The award that I'm competing for is about this sustainable new technology futures, and it's sponsored by companies like L'Oreal and fashion companies and people who are very much in these industries in New York City and who are interested in promoting more sustainable growth.
I think it's intriguing that they chose your project. They see something in there, even though it's not whatever, like the next thing to solve climate change, but clearly they saw what you're doing as important. Tell me more about, you wanted to shift gears when coronavirus happened. So tell me a little bit more about that and why you settled on this, why it's so important.
So initially I was doing this project. I was creating a new material out of a bimetal alloy that would curl and change form when exposed to temperature changes. So I was going to put it on a jacket type of thing. And when you would wear it, your body would kind of expand. Which is something that I'm still really interested in. It could be really fun. And I see the applications for a like social distancing jacket type of thing. But, and I had thought about it then as well. I had thought about the whole idea of using the biometal to create this fabric of social distance that would actually physically push people away. Mm-hmm. But when I rethought about that, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something that would actually, like, all of the news was so heavy. All of the reports that were coming out about kids in particular dealing with being stuck at home, sometimes in abusive family situations, sometimes, you know, they're just having a hard time losing their social network. A lot of very drastic changes. And being the mother of a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old myself, like, I understand for them it's these big changes, really, really big, hard changes. My daughter celebrated her 5th birthday alone, you know, with Zoom calls, and she was like really confused. She didn't know why that was happening. And so I just really thought that it was important to make something that could surprise people in a positive way, a way that was going for delight. Attempting to attain delight and surprise.
So people can go onto your website, and if they put rainbows in their windows, they can log that on. So Brio could perhaps come visit their neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, kids and adults seem to really like this. I've been getting a lot of comments from adults in particular. They're like, oh, it's so great. It's so great. And I'm so happy that like the effect has really come through, that people are really feeling it. They're like really like lightened up by this. I mean, there's so many heavy things in the world right now. So many of them are so important too. But that doesn't mean that we have to like live in heaviness. We can have both. We can have both.
Well, this is great. Well, thank you so much, Ashley. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
That was UNM student and artist Ashley Abbott talking about her project, Brio the Giant Snail. You can see photos of Brio at KUNM.org and follow Brio on Instagram. There's also a link to the giant street puppet show staged in London that Abbott said inspired her project. You can hear this episode and all our episodes of University Showcase at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.